It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Center for Media Innovation at Point Park University has chosen an inaugural winner for its $20,000 Doris O'Donnell Innovations in Investigative Journalism Fellowship. The prize is meant to fund 6 months of reporting in a media desert. The official announcement gets underway downtown in about an hour. The Confluence's Megan Harris spoke in advance to both Center Director Andrew Conti and this year's winner, Erica Hensley. She's a health and data reporter and Knight Foundation Fellow at the statewide online news outlet Mississippi Today.
Erica, we'll start with you. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling thrilled. We're a small nonprofit down in Jackson, Mississippi, so we're pretty familiar with the grant process, but this was a big opportunity for me, and I'm really excited. There was some really, really stellar pitches for this project, and they all centered on really important public health questions that I think we as reporters need to be focused more on. So I'm just happy mine made it to the top, and I'm really excited to be working with Point Park.
Andy, remind us a little bit about the prize and that nationwide search.
So at the Center for Media Innovation at Point Park University, we've been focused on this issue of news deserts or places where news outlets have either closed or shrunk their coverage areas. And so there are communities all across the United States that no longer have local media. And so we wanted to do this fellowship. We got a grant from the Allegheny Foundation to do the fellowship for at least 3 years. And we wanted to focus on not just only inspiring people to do great work and to get investigative journalism going, but also to do it in these places that don't have a lot of local news. And so that's what we were really excited about Erica's proposal, because she's talking about going into parts of Mississippi that just don't have any local news sources. And part of her proposal was, if I don't get the money for this project, no one else is going to do it. You know, unfortunately, we heard that from lots of the applicants. We ended up with 6 finalists, and we had dozens of other applications. And it was a really tough job for the judges, because there were so many interesting proposals in there.
Wonderful. So, Erica, you and your newsroom will share in the fruits of this $20,000 prize. Tell us about your proposal and what you plan to cover in Mississippi.
My project centers around lead exposure and the risk, particularly to children. And Andy mentioned, you know, if we don't do this story, it will not get told. And that's 100% right. Our news media that are across Mississippi are strapped. They are covering mostly just the cities within which they exist. We're the only fully staffed statewide nonprofit, so we're the only one covering, you know, coast to Memphis and everything in between. And this project about lead exposure is going to focus mostly on the Mississippi Delta, which is the area of the state that stretches along the Mississippi River and straddles parts of Tennessee and Arkansas. Of course, we'll focus on the Mississippi side. But we're going to look at the different ways that children get exposed to lead. And it can come, as I'm sure Pittsburgh residents are familiar with, through lead plumbing in your homes, through water, also through lead paint, and then just dust particles coming home from, you know, a parent's work boot or some other vector. But projects have centered on one of those ways that kids can get exposed. No one, including the state and all of the agencies that handle lead exposure here, have correlated all three. And that's really the center of this project. It's going to take a lot of data collection and a lot of data analysis on my end. And that's why the fellowship is so important. It gives me the time and resources to actually dig into the data, collect it myself, because like I said, a lot of the state agencies here are not collecting it in a way that really helps the public understand their risk. They might have it in piles and, you know, in file cabinets, but it's not being shared with the public. We've actually went ahead and started a community survey to get out in the Delta and ask people, do you know the risk in your home? Has your home ever been tested? Has your school been tested? Has anyone talked to you about this? And it's resoundingly no, which is what we expected. And I think a big part of this is just communicating with folks on the ground, letting them know. And I think that was a big part of the mission of the fellowship and a big part of our mission as a newsroom is to communicate with the people we cover, not just cover them, not just parachute in, but really work with them to help them live better, healthier, more informed lives.
It sounds like a lot of unanswered questions. How much do you feel like you know about this problem of lead exposure so far? Where do you begin?
Well, I think I begin with what I learned from my reporting in Georgia, which sees really similar variables to lead exposure, and what I've collected so far here, which the first reporting question was how many kids are tested for lead. It's supposed to be a universal testing for children under five, specifically children on Medicaid, which we have the highest proportion of in the country. We only test 7% of kids here. So that first tells me we don't know how big the problem is.
Andy, one of the big parameters of this prize is that it be in an underserved area. Is Ridgeland and Jackson and this area in Mississippi, as she's describing it, is that kind of what you had in mind?
Yeah, definitely. When we look across the country, there's so many places that, you know, newspapers have just either never existed or they've closed, and so there's nothing going on there. And so we ended up with proposals from a lot of different areas, obviously one in Mississippi, but there was a proposal for an area in North Carolina and Virginia where there were three counties with no newspapers. There was one for a statewide project in Pennsylvania that would have included two counties that also don't have local newspapers. There was a project in Alaska. There were lots of places out there across the country. And I would say, as discouraging as it has been in recent years to watch what's happening to journalism and as people are losing their jobs and news outlets are cutting back, it was so encouraging to be able to go through the proposals and see people putting forth ideas for solving these issues and doing it in a creative way.
Our guests on The Confluence are Andrew Conti. He's the director of Point Park University's Center for Media Innovation and its first ever Doris O'Donnell Innovations in Investigative Journalism Fellowship winner, Erica Hensley. Erica, how do you imagine that this project is going to expand on how you've already been able to cover this topic in Mississippi, but maybe more piecemeal than this will allow you to do?
I think it will come down to the impact. We tracked every single utility and found that most of them did not know where the lead service lines were. To your point about it being sort of piecemeal at this point, it's asking people who own the homes if they're in any position to replace those lead service lines once we do find them. We have a high proportion of renters here, especially in the Mississippi Delta, because it's the poorest part of our state, which is the poorest state in the nation. So there is not a lot of funds to stretch around for home repairs and things like that, that when done effectively really reduce the risk of lead poisoning. But if you don't have the money to make those repairs, then you are, you know, at more at risk than your kids of the same age and the same risk factors. If you live in an older house and your parents can't afford to replace the lead piping, you are at higher risk, which just puts you down the line on social determinants of health and makes it harder to live a healthy life. So I think taking what agencies have said they're going to do, what federal agencies and state agencies are trying to do to limit lead risk, and communicating that with the public.
And the infrastructure you're referring to, a lot of these lead service lines are on private property. That's the distinction between what the water authority actually owns and what the private citizen has to pay for.
Correct. Yeah. The utility's responsibility pretty much stops at the sidewalk area. And that's something we tried really hard to communicate in our Georgia reporting as well. Most people have no idea of that metric. They think, you know, my water utility says the water is safe, so whatever comes out of the faucet should be. And while that's generally true, we don't want to fearmonger. If you haven't checked your plumbing or the water actually coming out of the pipe, you really have no idea. And the water being tested at the utility has no correlation to what's actually coming out of the pipe, which is the same thing in schools. Some school districts across the nation have been mandating that school districts start testing. We haven't really seen that here in Mississippi. And it's a lot of don't ask, don't tell, unfortunately. If school districts don't have the funds to test, they're not going to take on that liability of probably finding something. So again, it just comes back to communicating with parents. If it's important to you to make sure your school district is testing for lead, I've had one public health expert compare a lot of these older faucets to the lead straws that kids are drinking out of. If it's important to parents, they need to know that the districts aren't doing that and help them empower their communities to go out and make sure that happens.
Well, talking about that importance, do you feel like the people in your area have a strong understanding of what lead exposure can do to them, to their children, themselves, the environment around them?
I don't. I think people in Jackson have a little bit more of an idea because we had some really bad lead issues here in the plumbing a few years ago. So it started to be more of a community conversation. But I think that speaks to the fact that people like to silo it off. Wherever they hear there's an issue, oh, that's a Flint issue, or oh, that's a Pittsburgh issue, or here, that's a Jackson issue, it doesn't affect me. And I really want to help sort of combat that misunderstanding. Because when places start to test with sound methods to actually look for the problem, if your infrastructure is old, you will find it. And that's what every public health expert you talk to will tell you, and what studies show us. But people just, it's an invisible poison, you know? It's not something that they can see. And if you're struggling to make ends meet and put meals on the table, which, you know, about a third of people in Mississippi struggle to do, it's hard to take on another thing that they can't see. But when we really dig into, you know, adverse childhood experiences, this is a huge contribution to that. And as I'm sure many of your Pittsburgh listeners know, it only makes it harder to live healthy lives down the line if you're exposed to lead as a kid. You can't reverse lead poisoning. You can only mitigate it. So I think we're really doing a disservice by pretending it's not an issue down here when we know it is.
Andy, how excited are you to hear all of this, all of these plans for future stories?
Yeah, we're really excited. I mean, this is the kind of project we had in mind when we proposed the fellowship. The cool thing for Pittsburghers is that Erica will be coming to Pittsburgh. She'll be on campus this fall, and then she'll be back two times in the spring, and she'll be working with students, talking with them on a regular basis. So it's pretty cool to be a way for Pittsburghers to be involved and to be able to follow her through this process. So it's not just like, here's the end product, but how does she actually go through the entire process, which would be pretty neat.
And working on a project, of course, that is talking about a topic that is just as prevalent here in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, it's top of mind for Pittsburghers, too, anyone who drinks water, right? I'm sitting here myself thinking, like, I wonder what comes out of my tap.
So. Erica Hensley is an Atlanta native. She's working as an investigative reporter at Mississippi Today and was just named the first ever winner of the $20,000 Doris O'Donnell Innovations in Investigative Journalism Fellowship. Erica, best of luck, and please keep us posted on what you find.
I will do, Megan. Thanks so much for having me.
And Andrew Conti is the director of Point Park University's Center for Media Innovation. Thanks so much, Andy, and congrats.
Thanks for having us back.
I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Who knew that four little chords could change the world? Smells Like Teen Spirit, Nirvana's Ode to Angst, became an instant anthem for Generation X, whether they wanted it or not. Kurt Cobain was always a reluctant frontman with a disdain for the misogynistic and abrasive music superstars of the day. Yet the group found themselves in heavy rotation on radio and MTV, on the front of every magazine, and inside the living rooms of, well, almost everyone in America. Nirvana's breakthrough single, Smells Like Teen Spirit, was released on this day in 1991. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Governor Tom Wolf has freed more Pennsylvanians sentenced to life in prison than his last four predecessors combined. This uptick is due in part to skepticism of a little-known law that punishes people for murder even if they don't directly cause a death. 90.5 WESA's Anli Herring has this report.
One night in 1986, a fight broke out at a party in Philadelphia. George Trudell was 20 at the time and saw the brawl between his friends Bobby and Kaz unfold. A knife fell from Kaz's coat, and Trudell remembers rushing to get it away from him.
And that fast, my buddy Bobby had snatched it out of my hand.
Bobby stabbed Kaz in the arm, and Trudell implored him to let Kaz go.
Bobby wound up stabbing him again. Kaz broke free and ran away.
Half an hour later, Trudell says, Kaz was found dead. Bobby eventually was convicted of third-degree murder and served 7 years in prison. Trudell, however, was found guilty of second-degree murder in a separate trial. He says prosecutors argued that he and Bobby had tried to steal drugs from Kaz. When a felony like robbery results in death, it's called felony murder, and everyone involved in the crime is liable, even if they were a driver or a lookout who had no idea their accomplice was armed. Trudell says he and Bobby didn't try to rob anyone, but the jury didn't believe him, so he got a life sentence. Ben Noderman of New York University says Pennsylvania stands out for punishing felony murder automatically with life without parole.
Pennsylvania takes a doctrine that's already really harsh and makes it that much harsher. And that's one of the reasons why you have so many people incarcerated for life in Pennsylvania.
Governor Wolf commuted George Trudell's sentence in April, and Trudell was released after spending 31 years in prison. The State Corrections Department estimates that 500 Pennsylvanians are serving life sentences today, even though they didn't directly cause the death of a victim. Allegheny County Trial Judge Jeffrey Manning once tried felony murder cases as an assistant district attorney. But he says even then, he was uncomfortable with how the crime is defined and punished.
Basically, it's based upon the concept that everyone who conspires with a conspirator who commits a crime that results in the death of another human being, that they are equally as culpable. And that just flies in the face of reality.
But Valerie Dixon of the Center for Victims says it's important to make people think twice before committing dangerous crimes.
When you're planning all this, if somebody gets hurt and killed, I can go to jail. Even though I don't even want to touch a gun, look at a gun, you know the possibilities at the end.
But Greg Rowe of the Pennsylvania District Attorneys Association says his organization could support a less sweeping version of the felony murder law. That way, for example, judges could hand out different punishments to an actual killer and the person who drove him to the scene.
The first thing that one needs to do is to really break out those categories, because they really do represent people having different levels of culpability.
One forthcoming bill would repeal mandatory life sentences in most murder cases. People convicted of felony murder would be eligible for release after 25 years behind bars. Meanwhile, Governor Wolf has freed 11 people serving life sentences. That's roughly twice as many since 1995. Almost half of Wolf's commutations were for felony murder, and there may be more to come. Attorney General Josh Shapiro sits on the Pennsylvania Pardons Board, which makes recommendations to the governor on clemency. He says the board should pay special attention to felony murder sentences. But he says ultimately the legislature has to act.
It's not ideal to handle these on a case-by-case basis before the Board of Pardons. I'd much rather see broad reform that can impact the entire system.
In the meantime, George Trudell says he'll play his part by setting a good example.
I feel as though I have a moral responsibility to the other men and women who are still incarcerated to do the right thing out here.
But in the future, he hopes no one in his situation will be sentenced to life at all. On Lee Herring, 90.5 WESA News.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. It's been about a year since Pittsburgh's two early music organizations, Chatham Baroque and Renaissance and Baroque, combined to form one performing and self-producing company. Donna Goyack is the executive director of Chatham Baroque. Welcome, Donna.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
And we're also joined by co-artistic directors and musicians Andrew Fouts, Patricia Halverson, and Scott Pauly. Thanks for coming in, everybody.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
The Baroque period was about a century and a half long. How did that music differ maybe from the Renaissance period that preceded it and maybe the classical era that followed it?
Well, the Baroque period is exciting for a lot of reasons to us. The Renaissance period was dominated by church music and often, you know, vocal music. We think of church polyphony, many voices singing together, you know, Byrd, Palestrina, that kind of music. The Baroque period kind of came along and destroyed that. It was very, very avant-garde and experimental in its time. They came along with the idea that the words should be the most important thing, because when you have eight voices singing together, you know, you can't hear the words. So they wrote music with just two parts, a bass and a singer, and that later translated into more virtuosic instrumental music as well, and that's what we tend to focus on in Chatham Baroque. So there are many forms developed, virtuoso sonatas, concertos, dance music of all sorts in the Baroque, and a lot of it is very emotional and very intense in a way that maybe you don't find so much in the Renaissance, though we love that music too. And in classical period following, say, Mozart, it's much more refined and in a way restrained. So in a way, we like the emotional rawness of the Baroque. Mm-hmm.
There's also an entity of improvisation that's very important in the Baroque. And so, for instance, in a cadence, it's just expected. The cadence would sound naked without some kind of cadential ornament that usually the treble player would play. But there's in all voices, really, whether it's basso continuo or a solo kind of voice, there is very strong elements of improvisation.
Is the Baroque period unappreciated, underappreciated? What might you say?
I would say it's sometimes misunderstood.
Mm.
I think there are conceptions out there of the Baroque being staid, cerebral, mathematic, and in some interpretations it's often played that way. And we find that that misses the point. And so a good deal of what we are about, our organizational or our musical ethos, is bringing out, what Scott was mentioning, the emotion, the affect, how this differentiated from the Renaissance in being entirely extroverted and communicative of right. emotional experience.
Donna, do you think it's still misunderstood today? If there were some misunderstanding back then?
I think there's a lot to learn about early music, which I myself have only been learning over the past 10 years. And I think the variety about it is very special. I think it is a lot more accessible than a lot of different kinds of music and is very inspiring.
I want to hear about the instruments themselves. You've brought a few along with you. Andrew, let's start with you. Can you tell us about the Baroque violin? What makes it different from a modern violin?
There are a few key acoustic differences. Let me grab it really quickly.
So it looks at first glance like a standard modern violin.
This is true. The body of the violin, the shape, the size, has been the same since the 16th century, the end of the Renaissance. The Baroque is really where the violin started coming into its own as a concert instrument, as a virtuoso instrument, as an instrument that kind of came out of the streets and into the court and into the church. One of its differences from a modern violin is that I don't use a chin rest. In terms of violin technique and pedagogy, it wasn't a part of the apparatuses that were utilized or the set, and it wasn't necessary for the setup.
Does it sound similar?
Yeah, it is tuned exactly the same way. In fifths, although we tune usually a little bit lower pitch-wise, the A is centered around 415 hertz. But in fact, that is just one of many different pitch centers that were utilized in the Baroque. But it does affect any pitch center that you have on any acoustic instrument affects the quality and the sound of the instrument. So that, in addition with the gut strings, make this violin project a little bit differently, a little bit more relaxed, a
any
little
difference
bit more
with
open sound.
I'm sorry. Any difference with the bow?
Yeah, a good deal. I'm holding now one of my shortest bows, which is a model from 1680. And I would say it's probably just over half the length of a modern bow. And it's definitely heavier at the base than at the tip. So you've got a strong bow stroke and a weak bow stroke naturally. And that really pertains to how you articulate music. And it correlates with sort of beat hierarchy. We talk about that a lot in terms of what beats are stressed in a bar.
Patricia, you play the viola da gamba. Did I get that correct?
That is right.
What does that mean?
The word gamba in Italian means leg, and so the instrument, when I play it, it rests right on my calf, so it's pretty close to me, and viola refers to a string instrument, which the gamba is.
Does it differ much from the modern viola in what you can do with it, the sounds that come from it?
Yes, I mean, the word viola is confusing because the viola, as we know it in today's world, is a member of the violin family. So it has four strings tuned in fifths. And the members of the viola da gamba family, and there are many different sizes. It's a product of the Renaissance, and so there's a treble, tenor, bass, many different sizes, and this is a bass instrument. The viola da gamba has six strings. The tuning is in fourths with a third. There are frets. Again, once you add them all up, there's quite a lot of differences, especially to a viola, which doesn't go as low as a viola da gamba.
Can you give us a little sample?
Sure. This is Oh, my E string's flat. It's kind of a new string. In any case, it's very typical for members of the viol family, viol is the English term for the instrument, to have a carving of a person or an animal or some wonderful creature. So this is a very beautiful woman, appropriately. This is Aphrodite, the goddess. And of course, she has no function in terms of the sound, but it makes for a very beautiful instrument.
Right, and it is a beautiful carving.
It is.
She's inspiring.
She is. In fact, the builder of both Andrew's violin and my instrument that I've got here with me, his wife does his decorative carving, and she is trained as a sculptor, so she brings some real skill to wood.
Lastly, Scott, you play the theorbo?
Yes, the theorbo. One of the instruments you don't hear every day, even in, you know, classical music settings, it's fairly unusual. But in the Baroque period, it was fairly common. The theorbo, it looks a little bit like a combination of a guitar and a garden rake. Or maybe something with a giraffe's neck on it, or an armadillo with a giraffe's neck. It looks a bit like a guitar or a mandolin. It's a plucked instrument. You hold it like a guitar, but it's got this really long neck. This is about 6 feet long. And so there are two sets of strings, one of the long on the long neck, and then a shorter set that are fretted just like on a guitar.
Will you give us a little sample?
Sure.
Yeah, oh, it does. It does look like a mandolin, a big mandolin.
So that's the upper strings, and then it goes all the way down.
Now, do you have to have a large wingspan to play this?
You know, it helps, but I actually have some really good friends who play the instrument who are not tall at all. So it's not a requirement by any means.
Mm-hmm. It's a member of the lute family.
Yeah, it is a member of the lute family. So the lutes are kind of half, if you imagine a pear cut in half, that's kind of the shape of a lute. And then the back is strips of wood, and the top is beautifully carved with three what they call rosettes. They almost look like a cathedral window. I think that's where they're inspired from, those kind of designs. And it's got some decorative hearts on the belly of the instrument, and so it's also a very beautiful thing to look at, like Patty's and Andrew's instruments. And that's kind of part of the whole Baroque aesthetic, is that like beauty is very much part of it, as well as like that expressing emotion in all its different forms.
We'll hear more from Chatham Baroque when the confluence continues. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. Our guests are Donna Goyack, Executive Director of Chatham Baroque, and co-artistic directors and musicians Andrew Fouts, Patricia Halverson, and Scott Pauley. Do people know, or do they think they even care about maybe the religious aspect, the religious roots of some Baroque music?
I think a lot of the music is religious, but I think it's also transcendent in many ways. So, you know, you can hear a piece, say, like J.S. Bach's Passion of St. John or the B minor Mass. You know, they have religious roots, as many pieces do. But I think if you go to that concert or hear it on a recording, you can have any kind of experience you bring to the table. If you're not a religious person, I think you might find spirituality there, but you don't necessarily in today's modern world find the same level of religious fervor maybe that was back in the day.
It so happens that in Pittsburgh, certainly most of our venues are churches, and it's not because we feel that the music needs to be in a religious space, but because religious spaces often have very flattering, attractive acoustics for our music. And a live acoustic works well for the instruments that we play.
And you might hear that definitely around Christmas time. I'm thinking of Handel's Messiah,
exactly,
and the Hallelujah Chorus.
Right.
Correct, yeah.
The Renaissance and Baroque Society was founded in Pittsburgh in 1969, I believe.
Correct.
Chatham Baroque got its start when?
The very first concert that members of Chatham Baroque, originally the Pittsburgh Early Music Ensemble was the name of the group, was in May of 1991. So our first season, which was quite modest, was 91-92.
So there was a merger in 2018. I'm going to get this to Patty and also to Donna. What was the reason behind the consolidation? Donna, let's start with you.
Those of us in the business know, it's really challenging to maintain a small to mid-sized arts organization. And there was clearly mission alignment between the two. And we saw it as an opportunity to form some kind of a strategic alliance between the two organizations. And those conversations eventually led to the merger of the organizations.
Mm-hmm. Patty, you were a founding member of Chatham Baroque. Is this consolidation allowing the one organization to do something that the two couldn't do separately? And what might that be?
It's allowed us to do many things, but one of the important things that we're seeing right now is we're offering two parallel seasons, or series, I should say. And so, as we've said, our wheelhouse is late Renaissance, 17th century, early 18th century music. And R&B's wheelhouse spans quite a great breadth from the medieval period into the classical. And so if we're creating both series, then we can really create a lot of variety within a year's time.
Mm-hmm. Chatham Baroque is not associated with Chatham University, but Pittsburghers should know that there's a relationship with that name Chatham, though. The Earl of Chatham?
Yes, that's right.
Right, William Pitt, after whom our fair city is named, although I understand he never came here, but he was an English nobleman, and he was the Earl of Chatham. So I think that's why we have in the city, you know, Chatham University, Chatham Center, Chatham Village, and of course, Chatham Baroque. So it goes back to that history.
Yeah, and he also, I think, had a lot of money that some of it went toward the French and Indian War.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So. Yeah. One thing I would add that the merger has allowed us to do is to market and promote the series to both audiences. And there was actually less crossover between the two than you would imagine. Mm. Yeah, the mailing list, for instance, only had a 10% crossover between the two audiences. So being able to create a season that has a narrative arc that spans the entire millennium of music, that is early music, and then promoting those in a cohesive voice. This past year, we raised attendance by 36% over what it was the year when the organizations were separate. So that's been really valuable to us.
That should be encouraging, because it's not like, oh, we're drawing from the same pool, if you would.
Yeah, exactly. It's been very encouraging, and the community has been very generous and responsive in a very good way to this merger.
It's also a great pleasure to think also outside of our domain of practice and study, which is Western Baroque music. And when we get into the, there's so many fascinating musical ensembles out there that are exploring the cross-pollination of music from different religions, from different faiths, and from different cultural styles that blend together throughout time.
Our guests on The Confluence are Donna Goyack, Andrew Fouts, Patricia Halverson, and Scott Pauley of Chatham Baroque. Donna, I'm going to start with you on this one and have all of you chime in, please. The upcoming season, give us an idea of the concert series. And for everyone else, what are you most looking forward to?
We can't wait to get this season started. The concert series, we're going to do something different this year in that the first concert is on both the Renaissance of Baroque series and the Chatham Baroque series. And it's going to be a really interesting collaboration. What do you care to talk about what that is in store for that one?
Yeah, the program is called Foreign Accents, and it'll be the combination of two ensembles, Chatham Baroque with the Four Nations Ensemble, which is a group from upstate New York and New York City, and featuring soprano Pascal Baudin, who's performed with our group many times. And the reason for the title Foreign Accents is because it's featuring composers who are writing in styles and languages that are not their own. So, for example, you have Germans like Bach and Handel writing in different languages. Handel writing, for example, in Spanish.
Mm.
Only piece he ever wrote in Spanish. He wrote a lot in English and Italian, but not many other languages. So really, really unusual piece for guitar, gamba, and voice that we'll be doing by Handel. There's a cantata by J.S. Bach that's written in Italian language. There's a French composer named Monteclair also writing in Italian. So it has that kind of unusual off the beaten track flair. And it's a great ensemble to combine with. They're really fine players. So we're really excited about it.
Patricia, what are you looking forward to?
The two programs I'm looking forward to on the Renaissance of Baroque series are quite broad in their chronological offering. So in January, we're very fortunate to have members of Sequentia come, and their title of their program, which was very newly created, is called Charms, Riddles, and Elegies of the Medieval Northlands, and it's music from the 8th through the 11th centuries, songs from different sources about laments and healing and, you know, all kinds of sort of weird stuff. And it's four instrumentalists and singers, and they will be accompanying themselves on a couple of different early harps and flutes, including a flute made from swan bone. Don't know what that means, but I'm intrigued. And then on the opposite side of the spectrum, we have Sylvia Berry coming from Philadelphia. And she plays a forte piano, which is an early piano. In fact, this is an 1806 restored Broadwood instrument. And I'm sure many of your listeners know what Haydn sounds like on a grand piano. But a forte piano has a distinct quality. And also the articulation options are different than a modern piano. So it's going to be a really beautiful program on a beautiful piano.
And Andrew, what about you? What are you looking forward to?
Well, I'm particularly looking forward to, amongst the Chatham Baroque concerts, the Henry Purcell concert that we're performing in November with the Pittsburgh Camerata. These are his odes to the patron saint of music, St. Cecilia. We're going to be with a 12-person choir, a 12-person orchestra, directed by Mark Anderson, who is the music director of Pittsburgh Camerata. And Purcell's music is just one of a kind. He's a late 17th century English composer who has his own distinct voice, very expressive. And here is this honorific piece to his patron saint, the patron saint of music, St. Cecilia.
And we'll have a link to the full list of the season on our website, wesa.fm. Final question. How do you appeal to audiences about the beauty of a live performance? Patty, I'll start with you.
Wow. I always say live music is better. There's no question. And not only is it the intimacy that you feel in that space, it's something that you're sharing with others. And there was really, it sounds cliche, but that sense of community that comes about whenever you're sharing a beautiful moment with other people. And our artists are very accessible, and they're friendly, and they're funny, and every performance is different. On the Chatham Baroque side, we'll do the same program three times in three different locations. And many of our audience members come back and will go to all three performances because each one is slightly different and a different experience.
Scott?
Yeah, I think that rapport with the audience and you know, speaking as a musician, it's just, it's great to have people in the room and they give us energy to play in a way that I don't think a listener would get so much listening to a recording, whether it's an iPod or a radio broadcast or something recorded. I think there's something very magical about live music.
Donna Goyack is the executive director of Chatham Baroque. Andrew Fouts, Patricia Halverson, Scott Pauly are co-artistic directors and the musicians. Thanks so much to all of you for joining us today.
All right, thank you. We enjoyed it. Kevin.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, Pennsylvania lawmakers return to session next week, and up for consideration is hashtag MeToo legislation. Who should investigate allegations? The bills that would eliminate non-disclosure agreements for legislators accused of sexual misconduct. If you missed anything from today's program, or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski.
The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.